title for this evening is Why Buddhism and the Modern World Need Each Other. Originally, the title was Why Buddhism and the West Need Each Other. But it seems to me that, for the most part, the West has become the modern world. In a very important sense, its projects, its ideals have globalized, which is why I think we can talk about the modern world. And I'd like to begin with a rather well-known quotation from the Zen poet Gary Snyder. About 50 years ago, he published an essay on Buddhist anarchism that included these lines. The highest ideal of the Western tradition has been the concern to restructure our societies. Oh, wait a minute. Is that me or is that Gary? Sorry. The mercy of the West has been social revolution. The mercy of the East has been individual insight into the basic self / void. We need both. Another way to say that, I think, is that the highest ideal of the Western tradition has been social transformation. The idea that we can restructure how it is that we live together so we live in a more socially just world. I expect that most of us here are all too aware of the ways in which we fall short of that, which is why I emphasize it as an ideal. But we also need to appreciate how much really has been accomplished in the modern era in just a few hundred years, thinking about a social revolution overthrowing oppressive dictators, kings, democracy, human rights, Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, anti-slavery campaigns, more recently civil rights movements, women's rights, and just in my lifetime, gay rights, gender rights in general. That's a lot, it seems to me. I think we're well aware of the ways in which things maybe are even getting worse, that especially, I think, the growing gap between rich and poor, but we really do need to appreciate this. On the other side, the highest ideal of the Buddhist tradition, we can even call it a project, is not social transformation, but personal transformation, individual transformation. The idea that we can awaken, we can realize something about the nature of ourselves so that we live in the world in a rather different way. And Gary ends by saying, we need both. Not, I think, simply because they go well together, these two ideals or projects, but I think we can see today that these two actually need each other if they're going to be as successful as we need them to be. And that's one of the main arguments I want to make, or one of the things I want to work toward. And of course, we live in a very special time where the globalization of our civilizations mean that these two projects or ideals are coming together and interacting with each other and learning from each other. And it seems to me, frankly, none too soon, given also the kind of ecological, economic, social challenges, crises that we're now facing. So what I'd like to do is start out by talking a little bit about the West, and in particular the spiritual roots of the West, which we really trace back to the Judeo-Christian tradition. And I'd like to contrast that with the roots of the Buddhist tradition. And in particular, I would like to look at their different attitude toward ethics, morality, because I think it's quite revealing, the difference between them. In this case, I'm not so much interested in the content. In other words, if you compare the Ten Commandments, say, with the five Buddhist precepts, as we would expect, there's some similarities and some differences. But I'm more interested in the function of that, because I think the difference in function, the different role of those ethical systems is very revealing about these. It really contributes to the way that these two ideals or projects have diverged. It seems to me that looking at the Judeo-Christian tradition, the most important duality or the axis is in fact moral. Well, we could say that the issue is good versus evil. That's sort of at the heart of the, at least the traditional way of understanding what's going on there, right? So God tells us how to live, with the implication that if we live in the way that he wants us to, we're being good, and somehow we'll be taken care of. And if we don't, then we're going to get into trouble. And for certain types of, say, Judeo-Christians, I'm thinking of certain types of evangelicals, or what we sometimes call fundamentalists, they tend to see the whole world in this way, as sort of this great struggle between the forces of God and Satan. Seems to me this goes all the way back to the very beginnings of tradition, the story of Adam and Eve and the way that they got expelled from the garden. Looking at it from a more Buddhist perspective, that story seems to me a myth about the development of self-consciousness, right? So like when they eat the forbidden fruit, Adam and Eve become aware that they're naked, and so they get fig leaves and they hide from the face of God. What's that referring to? A certain kind of self-consciousness. We could say, from that perspective, maybe it's not so much that they were expelled from the garden, but self-consciousness involves a kind of alienation, a sense of separation, so that they find themselves outside the garden. But be that as it may, what's quite fascinating, of course, is in biblical terms, what's important about the story, the way it's usually understood, is that it's about sin. We've disobeyed God, and we suffer for that. We get thrown out of the garden. It's a story, again, it's about good versus evil. And it carries on through. Noah's Ark. Why is it that God drowns, kills almost all humans and animals, except for those very few in the ark, right? Bit of an overreaction, I think. And I do wonder about all the other animals, you know, it's like just two by two. Did the other animals do something that evil that they deserve to drown? And the other thing I wonder about is all the evil fish. They kind of got off easily. But we get the point, right? And then it goes on, and we come to Moses, which is kind of the really heart of the Judaic tradition, right? The relationship, the covenant created between God and his people, the Israelites, who accept the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. Again, at the heart of it is morality. Are we going to live the way God wants us to or not? Jesus maybe adds a more intimate relationship with God, and I think maybe with, you know, God the Father, Abba. And also, according to scholars, I think he had some help from Paul, but a bit more emphasis on love. But nonetheless, he's still basically a kind of apocalyptic Jewish prophet. And we better behave ourselves because the last times are coming and we will be judged according to how we have been living. Now, by now you may be wondering, why am I going on and on talking about the Judeo-Christian tradition to a Buddhist audience? And the reason is that it seems to me, whether or not we believe in that kind of Abrahamic God, the story of good versus evil still remains our favorite story, our favorite sort of spectacles through which we like to observe the world. Think, for example, about our favorite films. I grew up with James Bond, right? The James Bond series, but also more recently, Star Wars. Good versus evil. Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, you know, add your own. Why are we so fascinated by this? And not only that, you think of television and all the spy series, the whole point of figuring out and catching the evil guys. It still remains our number one story. And the problem with that, well, it's not only the problem, but we can say from a Buddhist perspective, we can see that there's something wonderful about this story, but we can also see that there's something very problematical as well. Or if I want to be really cute, I can say that the duality between good and evil is itself both good and evil. Let me say a few words about that, starting with Messiah. The basic problem from a Buddhist perspective is that good versus evil is perhaps the classic example of what might be called dualistic thinking. Dualistic thinking, or bipolar thinking, is thinking that divides up the world, right, into sort of contraries. Other examples would be high, low, big, small, light, dark. We normally think of those as two separate concepts, right, high, low. But if you think about it, if you don't know what high means, you don't really know what low means. They're not two separate concepts, they're two sides of the same. And this is important not only logically, but also psychologically, because we can't have one without the other. Which means, for example, that if the most important thing for you is to live a pure life, whatever that means, it means that you are going to be necessarily preoccupied with impurity, right? It means that in every situation you have to discriminate what's pure and what's impure. You can't have one without the other. Which is why perhaps one of the great Chinese Chan or Zen masters said, true purity is to live beyond the duality of purity and impurity. But as I said, the classic example is of dualistic thinking like this is good versus evil. And in this case, what it means is that we don't know what is good until we know what's evil. It's like good is that which is other than evil. And also, we can't feel that we are good unless we are fighting against the evil. You know, preferably an evil that's outside ourselves. If we want to be good, we're going to have to find or create an evil. Going back, for example, to James Bond, how do we know he's a good guy? If you think, like, I'm assuming you're all familiar with one or another of James Bond stories. How do we know he's a good guy, right? I mean, he likes to drink, he likes to gamble, he has lots of casual relations with women, most of whom die somewhere along the way, right? How do we know he's a good guy? Because he's fighting against the bad guys. That's how we know, right? But historically, we can see how this has created all kinds of problems. We can look, say, at in the West, we've had inquisitions, heresy trials, witchcraft trials, the need to find an evil to be persecuted and destroyed. In fact, I think we don't have to go back so far. The war on terror might be a good example. I'm struck by how Osama bin Laden and President George W. Bush were actually fighting the same holy war of good against evil. What the one thought was good, the other thought was evil, so there was kind of a reversal going on there. But nonetheless, it was the same mentality, that in order for them to be good, they have to be fighting and trying to destroy the evil. What did George Bush say? If you're not with us, you're against us. I think that's a very strong duality. And what this points to is, I think, something very significant, that historically we can see one of the main causes of evil in our world has been our attempts to destroy evil. Let me say that again. One of the main causes of evil has been our attempts to destroy evil, or what we understand to be evil. What was Hitler doing by trying to eliminate the Jews? He was trying to purify the earth in his own way, get rid of the nasty, impure, evil elements. Or Stalin in the Soviet Union, he tried to get rid of the kulaks, some of the wealthier peasants. Mao Zedong with the landlords, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, with any educated people. Again, they're trying to perfect their society by destroying, getting rid, eliminating the imperfections. So there's something very tricky, very dangerous about this particular duality. On the other side, though, as I said, I think there's also something really, really wonderful about this duality that has led to our contemporary concern for social justice, which I think we can trace all the way back to the Hebrew prophets. What were the prophets doing? Well, one of the things they were doing is that they were going to the kings, to the rulers, and they were confronting them, they were challenging them, they were saying, you are not acting, you are not ruling in the way that God wants you to. You are oppressing the orphans and the widows and the poor, and God is going to punish you for it. And then they would run back into their hills with their flocks. What was going on there? It's creating this principle that good and evil isn't just something that applies to normal people. It actually applies to rulers. It applies to the authorities. Ultimately, it applies to the government, to the structure of society. And when we combine that with the other root of the Western tradition, right? The other root is classical Greece. And what did Greece contribute? Well, one of the main things we always refer to, of course, is democracy. Basically, what the Greeks realized, and this is something we take for granted today, so it's hard to appreciate how revolutionary it was in its day. But one of the things that the Greeks realized is that we can reconstruct our society if we're not happy with the way it's working. We can change it. We can transform it. So when we bring together, especially in the modern era, when we bring together this Greek realization, hey, we can totally restructure a society, with the Judeo-Christian concern for social justice, we get, in the, especially in the modern world where it really takes off, we get the kind of things that I referred to. Overthrowing oppressive kings, democracy, human rights, and so forth. And because of all that, we now live in a perfect world, right? Right? Maybe not. I mentioned earlier how in some ways things seem to be kind of moving backwards when we look, for example, about the stratification economically. It's pretty scary. Am I the only one who gets the sense that everything is being reorganized for the wealth and the comfort and the benefit of the very rich people? Do you have the same sense that I do? If we have this strong ideal for social justice, why is this happening? What's limiting it? What's interfering with it? And I wonder if we can put it like this. Imagine, if you will, that we all live in the best possible society. That is to say, with the best possible economy and the best possible political system. Whatever that means. But if you and I, the participants in this society, are still motivated by what Buddhism calls the three poisons, if still greed, ill will, and delusion, especially the delusion of separateness, the delusion that my well-being is separate from your well-being, if we're still functioning in this way, will that system really work? Can it work? Or won't it inevitably be subverted in some way? In other words, is it enough to work trying to restructure our social and economic institutions? Do we also need to look at the importance of personal transformation? To give another example, supposing you are a revolutionary leader who overthrows a really nasty dictator. But if you're still motivated by greed, it's going to be very difficult not to sort of take advantage of your new situation, right? If you're still motivated by ill will, very likely you will see people who have other ideas as problems, enemies to be controlled, if not destroyed. And if you still have your own ego, you know, your own delusion about your own superiority, what's probably going to happen is you're going to see that the solution to all the problems is simply to sort of impose your own ideas on society. And is the result of all that going to lead to the kind of socially just country that we want? Probably not. I think that's a pretty good example of the kind of limitation, or I think that points to the kind of limitation, again, of the concern for social justice. How it is that we have achieved a lot, but inevitably there's something that interferes with it. And I think that helps us understand the kind of situation that we're in today. Does that make any sense? Enough on the Western and modern side for the moment. Let me turn to the other side and look a bit at the Buddhist tradition, in particular the early part, the origin of the Buddhist tradition. I started out by looking at morality or social ethics. And I said that for the Judeo-Christian tradition, it seems to me the fundamental duality is good versus evil. It's that struggle between them. I don't think that's true for the Buddhist tradition. Yes, precepts are important, but nonetheless, they're not the most important thing. They're not the real heart of it. The Buddha himself says in one of the really important sutras how people are likely to praise him for superficial things, that is to say, his morality, and they miss the fact that what he has realized, these profound, deep, difficult to things, see things that he's realized. In other words, for Buddhism, the fundamental issue isn't good struggling against evil. If we want to put it in dualistic terms, we can say it's delusion versus wisdom. It is ignorance versus awakening, that there's something to realize. There's something cognitive in the largest or the broadest sense. And the way this tends to work is that in principle at least, it tends to cut, how to say it, someone who is really awakened, if he or she is genuinely awakened, they won't be inclined to behave in immoral ways. They won't be inclined to do things that are going to cause dukkha to other people. In that sense, I think morality in the Buddhist tradition is understood more kind of like training wheels in a bicycle. Very helpful at the very beginning, but once we learn how to ride, we don't need them anymore. I mean, it's not that you sort of get rid of morality, but it's simply that in a way you have discovered the root of morality. You have realized something about its nature. So what's the equivalent then to the Western, the traditional Western concern for social justice? What's the equivalent within Buddhism? Is it karma? Well, we might think so, right? I mean, karma, it's kind of, it can be understood as sort of, moral causation, moral cause and effect, understood in kind of a cosmic scale. It's sort of built into the structure of the universe. In a way, what we do comes back to us, right? But in practice, when we look at the way this has been understood in the Asian Buddhist traditions, it has not, in fact, encouraged the kind of emphasis on social justice that we found in the West. Why not? Well, it's interesting because karma, of course, is combined with the rebirth teaching and the idea that it's not only that what I do now is going to come back to me in the future in some way, but also what I'm experiencing now is a result of what was done in the past. The implication being that because of the law of karma being inescapable, you and I don't need to worry about it. It's like everyone sooner or later gets what they deserve. And so we don't really have to pay attention to it. And therefore, at least as I understand it, this has encouraged a kind of passivity. It certainly has not encouraged, as I say, really trying to make a society more socially just. We're all going to get what we deserve sooner or later. So if we're looking for the equivalent to social justice in the West, I think we have to come back to what is really the most important concept in Buddhism generally. Not justice, but dukkha, right? Dukkha, and maybe I should do a reality check here. Is everyone here familiar with the term dukkha? It's the word usually translated as suffering, of course, but that only works if we understand it in the broadest possible sense, not just physical and mental pain, but frustration, dissatisfaction, anxiety, or my favorite, dis-ease. We normally think that if we just solve all our problems and get everything we want, then we're going to be happy. And basically, the dukkha teaching is saying that it's not so easy, that it's the nature of our unawakened minds to be bothered by something. But here's the really big question. exactly what kind of dukkha did the Buddha have in mind when he said that all he had to teach was dukkha and how to end it? Is it the way that dukkha came to be understood in terms of my own individual karmic stream? Or did he perhaps have a kind of broader vision? It's hard to say, just from studying the Pali Canon, although some scholars, and I'm thinking of people like Trevor Lake and David Swartz, they really think that the Buddha wasn't just wanting to start what we think of as a religion. And they warn us against that. They say, be careful. Today we have a very weakened or enervated idea of religion. And it's important not to project that onto the Buddha and onto his times. They wonder whether he had a larger vision, that he was trying to start something that would transform the whole of society, not just start a separate organization of religious people. And there are two things in the early teachings that make me wonder if they're right, because they show that the Buddha was a more, at least they seem to show me, they imply, I think, pretty strongly, that the Buddha was more progressive than the institution that formed after he died. And the two that I'm thinking of particularly are his attitude toward women and his attitude toward caste. Let me just say a few words about each of those. First of all, women. We need to remember that at the time of the Buddha, the situation of women in India, or his area, were very poor. I mean, you know, for the Brahmanical culture, women had no spiritual role. I think they couldn't even recite the Vedas. They could have their tongues cut out or very severely punished. So the fact that the Buddha actually created a sangha, a community of female women monastics, who could become just as awakened as the men. Again, we take it for granted, but 2,400 years ago, that's absolutely huge. I think it's important for us to realize, too, that the traditional story that we find in the Pali Canon of how he did that is actually clearly distorted in some way. And that's important because, according to the story, the Buddha was very, very reluctant. And again, we can't tell for sure, but what we know in the story is that it doesn't make sense. That story doesn't work. I had an opportunity to talk about it with Bhikkhu Bodhi. And although he's the great translator, he himself was the one to emphasize this story just does not make sense. Right? Do you know the story? Okay, it goes like this, very briefly. The Buddha is, his foster mother comes to him, this another woman, and they say, look, we'd like you to start a bhikkhuni sangha, a monastic order for women. And the Buddha says, no. He goes off and they follow him and they're weeping and tearing off their hair, and they ask him again, and he says, no. And they ask him a third time, he says, no. And finally, Ananda, his attendant, says, look, Buddha, he wouldn't have said it quite like that, right? Sort of, oh, honored one, don't women, in effect, have the same potential to awaken as men? And the Buddha said, yes. And then, no, I'm changing things a tiny bit here, shortly. And then, so Ananda says, well, why don't we create a woman's order? And the Buddha says, okay. But, Ananda, because I do it, the women, he actually doesn't say, I'm going to create the order, but he says, if the women will follow these extra rules, then they can become monastics. And interestingly, these heavy extra rules, they forever subordinate the women to the male monastics. For example, a woman who's been a bhikkhuni nun for 50 years, she cannot say one word of criticism to even some boy who's only been a male monastic for one day. What's going on? Where did those rules come from? And then the Buddha also said to Ananda, look, but because I created this order for women, my dharma is going to disappear much more quickly than it would have otherwise. Fascinating story. I used to love it because I used to like the idea that the Buddha allowed himself to be persuaded by his young attendant. I thought, isn't that cool? And then I realized, no. The story is concocted the way it is to blame Ananda for ordaining women, you see. Because if you read the Pali Canon carefully, there's all kinds of stories about Ananda, and almost all of them are designed to show him in a bad light. In other words, the whole way the whoever put it together really had an end for Ananda. In fact, I think Kashyapa, the guy who sort of took over the order after the Buddha died, clearly we have other stories that he and Ananda had kind of some tension, some quarrel between them. So again, it's designed to blame Ananda. But also, think of this. It's believed that the Buddha created the Sangha for women about 5, 6, 7 years after he started teaching, and he taught for 45 years. But Ananda did not become his attendant until very late in his teaching career. It doesn't make sense. We also have evidence that the rules that the Buddha supposedly, the extra heavy rules that he imposed on women, at least some of them we think were created later. And finally, as Bhikkhu Bodhi pointed out, the whole logic of the story doesn't make sense. Right? He admits women in, and he says, because I've admitted women into the monastic order, everything is going to fall apart. What? I mean, if that were the case, he would have had to say something, you know, you would expect him to say something like, you know, look, Ananda, I'd like to let women in, but if I did, then the Dharma, the teaching is going to disappear, so I can't do it. But instead he lets them in, and then he complains because he let them in. I mean, the whole story is shot with all kinds of contradictions, which is important to remind us. Wonderful as the Pali Canon is, we have to read it critically. We can't just accept anything in there, right? I see this as very strong evidence that the Buddha was a lot more enlightened with regard to women than other people at his time, or for that matter, than the male monastics that took over after he died. Because, perhaps by no accident, within a couple hundred years after the Buddha died, the Bhikkhuni Sangha dwindled and in most places disappeared. My guess is the male monastics didn't like the competition. So that's one issue. Just notice, I think, just by virtue of what the Buddha did and then what happened. And of course today, every Asian Buddhist culture is strongly patriarchal. And as you probably know, there's lots and lots of resistance in many of those cultures to full ordination for women, to making them equal as monastics to men. But let me give the other example. And again, what I'm talking about here is just showing, I'm trying to point to things that really strongly suggest to me the Buddha had a deeper understanding, a broader understanding of dukkha and what's going on. He had a deeper understanding of society and social structure and patriarchy and, as I want to talk about now, caste. One of my very favorite stories in the Pali Canon talks about when a bunch of high-class young men, and I think at least one of them was related to the Buddha, they were out in the forest and they decided that they wanted to join the order. They wanted to become monastics. Maybe I should preface this by emphasizing the Buddha set up the order in such a way that is, when you become a monk or a nun, you lose all caste. I mean, caste was already pretty important in the India of his time, but within the order, there's no caste, right? The only hierarchy is seniority in terms of how long you have been in. And even that's not terribly important, but it applies to things like when you go somewhere new, who chooses where to sit first, things like that. So anyway, you have all these high caste men, I think there was 5 or 6 of them, and they decide to enter, and so they take off their rich clothes and their jewelry, and they give them to their servant, Upali. And they say, look, take these back to our families because we're not going to need them anymore. And then Polly says, oh, no way, no way. If somebody catches me with these clothes and jewels, what are they going to think? You know, they're going to think I stole them. They're going to think maybe I killed you or something. So I'm going to join the order too. So they all go to the Buddha. And what does the Buddha do? And thinking about this never fails to move me. Because the Buddha takes a look at these guys, and I can't tell what motivated him, but I can guess, right? He looks at these high caste, probably pretty spoiled young men. And what does he do? He sends them on a 2-week retreat, meditation retreat. And while they're on retreat, what does he do to Upali? He doesn't send Upali on the retreat. He ordains Upali. He ordains Upali, which means he, their former servant, actually closer to a slave, will forever be their senior in the Sangha. Do you see what that means? Do you see? What does that symbolize? What is he saying there? Wow. And yet, what happened after the Buddha died? The problem is that the early Buddhist Sangha was on royal support, or at least toleration. If the kings didn't like what you were getting up to, they could and sometimes would squash you, right? So you had to be very careful. And there was also some dependence for material support and things like that. So there was this kind of basic principle that if you want to be supported by the powers that be, you'd better support the powers that be, you see? And none of them was democratic. They were all, you know, pretty ruthless kings. So what happened over time? Well, Buddhism, in order to survive and thrive, got this kind of, it had to come to some accommodation with the state, with these kings. You know, some of whom were pretty nasty, very impressive, but Buddhism didn't challenge them. I mean, there are stories of the Buddha being consulted and talking to the kings, but in the Buddhist tradition, it's not prophetic. They're not challenging the kings in that way. And in fact, what happened, of course, is that the way it developed, the karma teaching could be and was used to rationalize the power of the kings, you see? If you're a king, well, you must have very good karma from your past lifetime to have been born prince and to become a king. And if you're born poor and sickly and disabled in some way, well, I'm sorry, Dennis, but don't blame anybody else. You must have done something really bad in a past lifetime. Right? And you. You're a woman. Well, I'm really sorry for you because you must have done something really bad in a past lifetime. But if you do what we meant to do, then you have a fair chance to be reborn as a man in your next lifetime, and then you'll have the possibility to follow the path and become enlightened. We can laugh about it, but in effect, that's what happened. Which is why the Buddhist tradition, you see, ended up not developing the concern for social justice, or what you might call social dukkha. It didn't develop the concern for looking at the way society might be structured that causes dukkha. No, instead what the Buddhist tradition did, and you know, we have to be appreciative of this too, is it focused on individual dukkha, individual karma, my own individual karmic stream, and the challenge of understanding what's going on in my own mind, and working with that. So the emphasis is on my own individual dukkha, my own individual practice, my own individual awakening, which puts an end to dukkha, you see? And that's how Buddhism survived and did so well within all of the Asian Buddhist traditions. Again, emphasizing none of this was democratic, so, you know, we can understand why it developed in the way that it did. But here's something else about the Buddhist tradition, that the Buddhist emphasis on impermanence and its substantiality also applies to Buddhism itself. Right? I mean, it means that the world is not a collection of things that just occasionally bump into each other, but that the world is really a confluence of processes, each of which is dependent on many other processes. Everything is in process, everything is transforming all the time. And This also applies to Buddhism, which we can see. We can see how when Buddhism went to a new culture, a new society, it didn't just impose itself violently, but it engaged in a kind of interaction. So when Mahayana went to China, there was kind of natural affinity with, especially with Taoism, and it was the interaction between those two that created Chan, or Zen, the tradition that I've practiced in. But now, Buddhism comes to the West, or as I said, comes to the modern world and faces its greatest challenge ever. A secular world, a modern world sort of at the height of its power, but also with incredible dukkha, dis-ease, sense that, you know, things aren't going quite right. There's huge ecological and economic problems here as well. So one of the main things that's going on now, Buddhism comes to the modern world, it is having to change, just like it changed before, inevitably. And one of the things that we can see is there's the possibility for developing the kind of concern for social justice, for understanding the institutional side of dukkha, right? By that, I don't simply mean adopting wholesale the kind of Abrahamic Judeo-Christian way of talking about social justice. I think Buddhism has its own way of talking about it. For example, I think that we can see today the Buddha's teaching about the three poisons or the three fires, greed, ill will, delusion, the three problematical delusions, three problematical motivations, or three roots of evil. We can see how today they have become institutionalized. Greed isn't just an individual issue regarding your own individual, my own individual karma. I think we've institutionalized it into our whole economic system. If greed means you never have enough, what does that say about a kind of economic system that has to keep growing if it's not going to collapse? Consumers never consume enough. Corporations never profitable enough. Collective GMP, GNDP, never big enough. Does that fit the definition of greed? Likewise, institutional ill will, I think that's our militarism. We live in the most militarized society in human history, especially if you measure it just by the amount of resources, the amount of money that we put into it. Huge military industrial corporate complex. Much greater than Eisenhower could have ever anticipated. Back in 1960, his farewell address, he, a former general, warned us about it. And he had no idea how pervasive it had become. And here again is part of the tragedy. If you spend trillions of dollars on your military, hey, you've got to, for doing that, you've got to keep finding enemies. You've got to keep finding and fighting wars. That's built in, right? If you're going to fund the military, if you're going to be the good guys, you've got to find the bad guys. Keep trying to destroy them. And likewise, I think we've institutionalized delusion in our main international media, which really have become our kind of collective nervous system. I mean, they inform us what's actually happening. They actually create reality for us by emphasizing what's important. But the point is, of course, that the major media are not simply about educating or informing us. They're mega corporations that make their money by finding ways to grab our eyeballs and sell them to the highest bidder, that is to say, with advertising, which means that they're not going to question the whole consumerism. On the contrary, that's what they depend upon for their profits. Instead, they're going to spend a lot of their... Instead, they're going to be working to normalize. They're not going to be helping us look at that and see the kind of problems associated with consumerism. They're going to take it for granted, and they're going to work to ensure that we, too, take it for granted. You see? I don't know if that makes any sense, but I think those are ways we can understand how the three fundamental problematic motivations that the Buddha referred to, greed, ill will, delusion, have become institutionalized. So in the modern world, in this time of great crisis, we can see how the Western, now modern, concern for social transformation and the Asian Buddhist concern for individual personal transformation, how they come together. And what I've tried to point out is how they need each other. And I think we can see that too in terms of freedom, how really they're talking about not two types of freedom, but the two sides of freedom. Look at it this way. The richest person in the world is, by most standards, pretty free in the sense that he or she can do pretty much what they want. But if their mind is still full of greed, ill will, delusion, would we want to say, from a Buddhist perspective, that they're free? In an important sense, they're not. But we can look at it from the other side too, say what goes on in Burma. Maybe a few years ago, although I'm not sure how much better things are now, you might have, say, a monastic in Burma who's been practicing for a long time and is maybe a quite enlightened, quite developed, but nonetheless, he can't speak freely what he says. He has to be very careful because he can get in trouble with the government. He and his family and his friends are oppressed by a military junta, which skim the cream, all the wealth off the society, and leave most people in a situation where they can barely survive. Do we want to say that this person is free? Is a person in that society free, even if he or she is enlightened? Not enough. I think we can see both kinds of freedom are absolutely necessary. And we have to find ways to work and to bring them together. And this brings me to my final point. I think within the Buddhist tradition, we have a wonderful archetype that in fact does exactly that, or rather can be slightly modified to bring those two together. The concern for personal transformation, combining that with the concern for social transformation. I'm referring, of course, to the Bodhisattva. What's special about the Bodhisattva path is that he or she continues to meditate. They have their own personal practice. It's not as though that's come to an end. At the same time as they don't understand the practice as simply being about sitting on the cushion facing a wall meditating, they also know that it's also important to get up and get out and be engaged with the world. One of my all-time favorite quotations is not by a Buddhist, but I think he makes the same point, Nisargadatta Maharaj, when he says, "When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love." Between these two, my life turns, right? I look inside and see that I am nothing, wisdom. Look outside and see that I am everything, love. The two pillars of the Buddhist tradition, wisdom and compassion. And one of the things I love about this quotation is the way he shows how well they fit together. Because love isn't simply some kind of feeling or emotion. Love is the way of being in the world that embodies the realization that I'm not separate from you, and therefore my well-being is not separate from yours. And that's what I think the Bodhisattva is working toward. Sometimes if you read the original Asian sources, there's the sense that the Bodhisattva is kindly sort of sacrificing his or her complete awakening. They choose to stick around here, this world of samsara, to help the rest of us. But I really think that misses the point. Right? One way to say it is that as we practice, as we begin to open up, as we begin to see through the delusion of separation, and realize that we're not separate from other people, then as that's beginning to happen, it doesn't mean, therefore, that all of my deep-rooted, habitual, self-centered tendencies automatically disappear. They're still there. How do I work through them? How do I begin to actualize what I'm starting to realize about my true nature, seeing through the delusion of separation? How do I actually actualize that? Well, it means I have to transform my actual ways of living in the world, changing those habits. sense. So instead of asking in the usual way, you know, what's in this for me, how can I get what I want, it's rather learning to live in a more selfless way. In which case, that practice is not a sacrifice on the part of the Bodhisattva. It's actually an essential part of his or her own personal transformation, his or her own personal practice. What's important, and maybe this is the revision that I think isn't so clear in the Asian traditions. As a Zen student, we tend to recite every day the four Bodhisattva vows, and the first of those is, sentient beings, living beings, are numberless. I vow to save them all. Right? Save, in that context, is often understood as help them become awakened. Maybe teach them how to meditate or something like that. But there's two important issues there. First of all, I think we're in a situation now in this world where we need to see that saving must be understood in a much broader and more socially engaged, more ecologically engaged way. Rather than simply looking at other people and trying to help them be enlightened, we have to address these broader types of dukkha. The dukkha caused by ecological destruction, by economic disparities, by social oppression, and things like that. And the other thing that's so wonderful, and I honestly sometimes wonder if this is the most important thing that Buddhism may have to offer in the modern world, right? Is actually bringing these two practices together. Because in our individual practice, one of the important things we develop is non-attachment to results, which means that when we do get off our cushions and go become engaged in the world, dealing with the frustrations that inevitably accompany that, right? So often, when we think about activism, we think about our own activism and that of people we know, we see how much it's accompanied by frustration, bitterness, anger, us versus them thinking, burnout, sometimes depression and nihilism. But if we have been working on our own individual practice and cultivating this non-attachment to results, it means that we can get up and we can work in the world, and when things don't go the way we would like them to, rather than getting burned out, we have this groundedness in the practice that can help to sustain us. And I wonder if that today isn't becoming more and more essential. The other thing that we really emphasize in the Zen world is what might be called don't know mind, that we don't really know what's possible. I remember one of my teachers, Robert Aitken, saying, our task is not to clear up the mystery, but to make the mystery clear. And I emphasize that because, you know, awakening isn't about suddenly, oh, now I understand how everything works. It's about we open up to a universe, a world that's essentially mysterious, and we don't fully understand what's going on and can't, but nonetheless our responsibility remains. And what I'm trying to point out here is this. A bodhisattva, and I think today we're all being called upon to become bodhisattvas. A bodhisattva does the very best he or she can, not knowing if anything they do makes any difference whatsoever. Let me say that again, right? A bodhisattva does the very best she can, not knowing if anything she does makes any difference whatsoever. Because we can't know, but nonetheless we still have the responsibility to do what we can. Ecologically, are we already past tipping points and maybe civilization or even the human species is doomed? It's possible. The point is we don't know. And it's part of our responsibility to do the very best we can within that context. Part of the mystery of the world is that we don't really understand and can't fully grasp what are the possibilities. Some of us here grew up, as I did, in the Cold War. Remember the great struggle between the West and the Soviet bloc? And we all lived in fear in the likelihood that we would end with the nuclear war. We took all that for granted until one day we woke up and communism, the communist bloc, collapsed. The Cold War was over. No one saw it coming, not even the CIA. You could say the same thing about Nelson Mandela in South Africa. I mean, one day he's in Rikers Prison, the next day, what? He's president of South Africa. It's like, the world is really mysterious. It's a strange place we don't know. And yet our responsibility within that don't knowing remains. The Bodhisattva, that wonderful first vow, sentient beings are numberless, I can't save them all. It's a vow to do the impossible. It's a vow to achieve the impossible. Maybe that's what we are called upon to do now. To be called upon to achieve the possible, then, it's not about that goal orientation that we're all so caught up in most of the time. It's about a fundamental reorientation of the meaning of our lives and the direction of our lives, and how we have to bring that in. You know, we have to find that and bring that in our practice and bring it into the social institutional structural challenges that we face today. I remember Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, said something very fascinating. He used to say to his students, "You're all perfect just as you are, but you can all use a little improvement." That's profound. And I think it also applies to our world. Through our individual practice, we realize that dimension where the world is indeed perfect just as it is, in the sense that there's nothing to gain or lose, there's absolutely nowhere to go. But we don't just sit and dwell in that, what we call clinging to emptiness in Zen. It's not just form is emptiness, emptiness is form. We also have to live in that other dimension where, in fact, the world can use a little improvement, or maybe even more than a little. It's those two aspects. It's those two dimensions. It's those two perspectives that we must bring together and learn to live in our own lives and learn to practice together. And to conclude, it really seems to me that if we as Buddhist practitioners can't do that or don't want to do it, then Buddhism is not what the world needs right here and now. And I mean that very sincerely. If we can't do it, if we don't want to do that, if we can't bring in these two ideals, these two projects, personal transformation and social structural transformation, then given the kind of crises that we face today, Buddhism is not what's needed. But what I've tried to do in my talk is point out, I think, the resources and the implications within the Buddhist tradition that I think can help to potentiate, can help us turn and open up to combining these two concerns. Does that make any sense? Thank you all very much. I think we have some time for some questions and discussions. I think we normally go on until, well, it's about 20 till now, 20 to 9, so.
I just need 3 minutes at the end to do rideshare and a quick Dhamma talk.
Great. Okay. If anyone has to leave, please feel free. Don't be uncomfortable about that, but for the rest of us. Also, is it possible to get more light? Let there be light. Maybe I'll be enlightened. The floor is open. Please feel free. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. That was a wonderful pulling together of that comparison. And I was actually kind of surprised when I was with you in the sort of social justice on the Western tradition and then the Buddhist tradition, and you said, it's sort of, where do we look for the social justice tradition? And I had it like, right, but that's not what you said. I was going to say interdependence.
Say?
Interdependence.
Interdependence.
And you said dukkha, which got me to thinking that in some ways, I think you could tell the story that both good and evil in the West and dukkha in the Eastern that got co-opted as a kind of social control. But the deeper teaching that I think is relevant for social justice, which of course you come back to with the Bodhisattva, is wisdom, the recognition of interdependence. You can't not act, because as I understand it, your whatever happiness or liberation is completely dependent on all those within you.
Thank you for that. Yes, I think that's a really important addition or concept to use, perspective to bring in here. And what occurs to me is the idea, so what we're really talking about is the interdependence of dukkha too, right, among other things. I mean, it's quite fascinating to me. On the one hand, Buddhism emphasizes interdependence, but then when we think about dukkha, you know, my karmic stream is completely separate from your karmic stream, right? Well, wait a minute here. I can't remember, did I mention the Tibetan teacher that I mentioned today, who talked about the Jews in Nazi Germany? Did I mention that? I was astonished. Well, astonished isn't quite the word, but... disturbed, there we go, when I once heard a Tibetan teacher say, oh, what terrible karma all those Jews in Nazi Germany must have had to be born in that place at that time. And I thought to myself, oh my God, this, you know, blame the victim, this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable, blaming the victim. We can't tolerate anymore that kind of narrow-minded understanding about dukkha and the cause of dukkha. You know, we know too much about how people can get caught up in massive social movements and how they can suffer as a result of that. So simply trying to understand all the suffering in my life as due to something that I've had done in the past, first of all, it's not even true to what Buddha said in the Pali Canon, by the way. But the way the tradition has developed, that's what we tend to focus on. You know, it's my own individual dukkha, it's my own karmic stream. And ignoring this emphasis on interdependence, you know, it's crazy. Another way to say it, if I can very briefly, think about this. Supposing that I killed somebody in a past lifetime, and then in this lifetime, if we take a simplistic understanding of karma, then at some point somebody kills me. But the person who killed me, does he get the karma for killing me? Right? It's like, it really gets kind of weird when you start thinking about it in these terms, and it just doesn't make sense, right? So, frankly, I wonder if we have totally misunderstood what the Buddha was trying to get at when he talked about karma, right? Karma, at the time of the Buddha, most people believed in it, but they understood it rather ritualistically. It's, you know, if you sacrifice in the right way, you'll get what you want. A very important part of the Buddha's revolution was his emphasis on motivation and intention, that that's what creates karma. But I don't think we've realized how revolutionary that actually is. We're still thinking in terms of consequences, but I think the Buddha was saying something different, something like this. He's offering us a golden key to transform how we experience other people, how we experience the world, how we relate to other people, how they experience us and respond to us. A very simple golden key, not necessarily easy, but very simple. He's saying, transform your motivations. The person who is motivated by greed, ill will, and delusion lives in a different world than a person who is motivated by generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. If I'm motivated by greed, etc., you know, I'm kind of, you know, how do I relate to you so I can get what I want from you? You know, there's kind of, it reinforces separation, it reinforces manipulation. But if I'm motivated by the opposite, if I'm motivated by generosity, loving kindness, the wisdom that acknowledges that our well-being is, my well-being isn't separate from yours, I can be a completely different kind of person. I can open up, I don't have to play any games, I don't have to pretend, I can be transparent. And I'm going to actually experience all of you differently because that's what I'm doing, you see. I think that's what the Buddha is saying. The karma teaching is actually incredibly empowering. It's not about passively accepting whatever happens to me, But it's saying, right here, right now, I have the ability to choose what I'm going to be motivated by, and that is going to determine how I actually experience the world. I'm reminded of the last line in Spinoza's Ethics, where he says, happiness is not the reward for virtue. The good life, right? Happiness is not the reward for a good life. Happiness is the good life itself, because the virtuous person lives in a different world. And I think somehow we've lost that, and yet I think it's quite clearly what the Buddha is pointing to. I've talked too long. My wife is going to give me a hard time later on for doing this. Anyway, thank you for your question. And what do other people think? Please.
I have a question. I really like how you've put together the Judeo-Christian and Buddhism and what they each have to bring. And I'm curious, and this is a big question, I know. I'm curious about Islam and what it brings to that mix.
Right. Well, in this context, Islam is part of the same stream, right? We talk about the Abrahamic traditions, the main ones being Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and they all have much the same perspective. It's the same good versus evil mentality. Yeah. I didn't go into that because, of course, that hasn't been so formative in the history of Europe and the West and the modern world. And, of course, nowadays we have all kinds of problems there as well, which I don't go into because they don't sort of help with this particular analysis. Yeah. I mean, it seems to me Islam, Christianity had a really hard time of it too, but we had a Reformation. And as a result of that, slowly, 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 we've learned to live in a more sort of tolerant way. Not by choice, right? We had these wars of religion where the Catholics and the Protestants did everything they could to destroy each other, and they couldn't, so they had to finally learn to live with each other. I think a lot of Islam's problem nowadays is that it sort of really hasn't had that Reformation. But anyway, that's another story. Please, Dennis.
You know, one of your books is The World is Made of Stories, and to see our stories and to see which are beneficial and which aren't, and what your talk is making me reflect on today is there's a story in the Judeo-Christian sense about, you know, that our true happiness is, you know, if we live the right life, we will die and experience happiness in the afterlife and in union with God. And there's a certain version, maybe in the Buddhist version, of what story do we have about enlightenment and awakening as something that if we practice is going to happen in the future. And both of these, I mean, the dark side of both of these, or a misunderstanding of both of these maybe, is that it's awakening in this moment that what's happening in the world is true. The crisis, you know, that we're needed here now in awakening even to the difficulties. So I just wanted to think of any more thoughts about that from both of these perspectives, that how does our story and our image of awakening in either of these traditions trip us up, and how does it contribute?
Thank you for that soft question. But this is something that it's in the new book, and it's something that I was thinking about for a long time, because ever since I retired from academia about 5 years ago, I've spent a lot of time doing this sort of thing, and usually talking about social engagement, Buddhist social engagement, often eco-dharma, and I've been really surprised how much indifference and sometimes resistance I found on the part of Buddhists. And so I've wondered, what's going on? Why is that? And then a couple of years ago, I was reading a book by Loyal Wu, where I came across a passage that just crystallized for me so well what was making me uncomfortable about Buddhism, or more specifically, certain ways of understanding. In other words, one of the Buddhist stories. Let me just say it like this. I think one of the reasons some Buddhists like some Christians, don't really want to get engaged with, say, ecological crisis is because we're caught up in what Loyal Wu calls cosmological dualism. You know, I mean, in the Buddhist terms, that means like samsara, nirvana, right? I mean, If you go back to the Pali Canon, there's a very strong theme. It's not the only one, but it's a very strong theme, right? That this is the world of samsara, the world of suffering and craving and delusion. And hey, you don't want to fix it. You want to escape it. You want to transcend it. You want to go to nirvana. And part of nirvana is you're not reborn here. Right? Well, if that's true, why waste our time trying to fix up this world when our ultimate destiny is going somewhere else? And the other thing Moya Wu pointed out was the idea of individual salvation. Right? In Buddhism, he was also applying this to Christianity, etc. But in Buddhist terms too, right? It's like, you know, I know you're all practitioners, I hope you're all going to awaken and become enlightened, but whether or not you do, I'm going to become enlightened and I'm going to be okay. You see? It's like this kind of, my well-being is ultimately separate from your well-being. Again, that too easily distracts us from really getting engaged with the social issues that bother all of us and the ecological issues that challenge us now. This kind of cosmological dualism. The other side of it is, I think because many of us in the modern world don't know what we think about things like rebirth, cosmological karma, we're not sure. Science hasn't discovered anything that seems to support them. I think that there's a very strong tendency in modern or Western Buddhism to understand the Dharma as in kind of psychological terms, that it's simply about my own mind. All the problems in my life are simply due to the way my mind works, my own traumas, my own emotional hang-ups, and if I can just clean that up and work that out, and then my life is going to be perfect, I'll do my job just great, I'll be harmonizing all the better with my family. But again, it's the same problem. It's sort of, it's like, it's all about me. It has nothing to do with social dukkha, you see? So whether I want to transcend this world or fit into it perfectly, there's no understanding that maybe my own well-being is not separate from the well-being of the whole, from the well-being of other people. And one consequence of this, if I can just put it this way, is I think this helps explain the kind of solution to climate change. I think we Buddhists have our own solution to the climate change problem. Did you know that? We do. When I get new information about what's happening, and it's usually kind of scary, things are worse than they thought, they're happening more quickly than expected, etc. Well, how do I feel? Well, kind of depressed, maybe anxious, worried. Hey, but I'm a practitioner. I'm a meditator. I know what to do when I feel depressed and anxious and worried. I go and I sit and I meditate for an hour, and it goes away. And I stand up and I feel better. I've solved a problem. I think it is funny. But it's funny because there's some truth to it, right? It's a short-term solution, needless to say. And of course I'm exaggerating, but there's some of that. We're taught in our tradition, you know, that's how you address those kinds of problems in our mind. But that is not sufficient. So what I talk about in the new book is I say, I think it's really important to understand the path is not about transcending and escaping this world, nor is it simply about psychologically fitting into it. It's about realizing that with the path, I deconstruct and reconstruct my relationship with other people and with the world. I deconstruct and reconstruct my sense of self. It's about this deconstruction and reconstruction. The reconstruction being what I said about karma, changing my motivations, and the deconstruction, what's happening when we're meditating. And if we do that, we can also see that the kind of reconstruction that's necessary today isn't simply my own mind, my own life, my own being, but we can see that today we also need a broader social institutional reconstruction. As far as how we live together, how we work together, how we dwell on this earth, that the kinds of reconstructions and deconstructions. I think this is the way we need to understand the path, which is a major part of what I'm arguing in this new book. Does that make any sense? I kind of flashed through it really quickly. Maybe time for one more quick question. I don't know who to... Sir, you're on the left here.
But isn't the Bodhisattva ideal the complete opposite of the escapist?
Yes.
And yes. Isn't it going to be almost parallel to the missionary, Christian missionaries, in a sense of going out and trying to be compassionate to everyone and helping everyone? Or is that really just a small portion of Buddhism that is interested in the Bodhisattva ideal? I don't understand how many Buddhists aspire to Bodhisattva.
It's a very good question. You know, we emphasize it much more in Mahayana, which is, and Zen is a kind of Mahayana Buddhism, than, so this is more, it's stressed more, and it's stressed less in the Theravada or the Pali, the earliest tradition. Yeah. In a way, that's what I was trying to talk about, of course, that I think we have this archetype that's here. I think what we need to do is to modify it and bring it up to date so that we're not just talking about helping other people awaken, but that we're trying to work together to address the kinds of social and ecological challenges that we face. We have this archetype, we have this resource, we have this wonderful model within the tradition that I think we need to build upon today. So, I agree completely. But, you know, within the Buddhist tradition, there's tensions, there's differences. And so what I was referring to was more the emphasis that is found in the earliest recorded teachings that the path is about simply transcending this world and suggesting that's not sufficient anymore, I think. There was one last question, maybe. Sir, please.
Yeah, so last week, Jeb Bush came in trouble because he went to insist that he would still go in and war in Iran. And every other candidate said, no, they wouldn't do that. No one would be home in it. That was wrong. It was a bad decision. It was wrong one. So I guess what you're saying is, though, that given our set of assumptions in the West that usually operate, even if that story is published in every newspaper in the country, as it probably was, we're still going to look for the next enemy. So we're still going to look for the next evil to fight against. Even though we just admitted, Republicans and Democrats, that war was wrong.
Well, what about Afghanistan? What about ISIS? It's not that we're going to go looking, it's not simply that we're going to go looking for another enemy, we're going to create them, right? And that's the wonderful thing about the war on terror, is that...
So my question is then, at what point is there a point of access or an alternative point of view which you are actually advocating? How does that get into this discussion?
How do we address that?
Yeah, how if you have an idea that there's another way to bring assumptions in from the Buddhist side,
right.
Where does that enter in?
Right. Well, there's a lot of things we could say. One thing I've sometimes wondered about is, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a Department of Peace that, if we just took 1% of the hundreds of billions of dollars that we spend every year on our military and spent 1% not simply fighting and trying to destroy the people who hate us, but asking why it is they hate us so much, what it is that we're doing that's causing them to hate us so much. You know, maybe we can look at our legacy in the Middle East, and if we look frankly at what we've done and why we've done what we've done, maybe it's quite understandable why so many people in that part of the world hate us so much. The scary thing about the war on terror, you know, with the collapse of the Cold War, the Pentagon had a real problem. Because how are you going to justify having all this huge, you know, we were all waiting for the peace dividend that never came, but that's why the war on terror was kind of the perfect solution, in a way. It may never end. It's already the longest war in our history. How would we know if it ended? I mean, the whole way we're prosecuting it right now with drones and all that, you know, every person we kill has friends and relatives and all that, it's almost intentionally, that's too cynical, but it's almost as if it's prosecuted in a way that's going to constantly recreate more and more people who hate us. And my guess is there's more and more people who hate us now than on September 11th, simply because of the way that we've responded to that. So it's a huge issue, and you know, we don't have time to go into detail, but I think we need to look at our responsibility, how it is that we've created the conditions that then cause hatred and cause people to respond in a way that we do. I appreciate that's a very superficial reply, but I also know that Dennis has to get in here. Thank you.